tonight our speaker is Don Benny. Benny, pardon me. And he's going to speak about Mac OS X, the Leopard release, the newest release, and some of the good Unix features in there. Don is the co-president of the Gamma users group here in town, the Macintosh users group, and he's also done similar presentations on Leopard here in the last few months, and they've had good reviews, so we figured it'd be good to have him here and speak to us tonight. When he's not doing this kind of stuff and being at Gamug, he's up on the fifth floor of this building, so he had a long trek to get here tonight. He's a Gray Bar employee, he's a senior network specialist.
Yes.
And
But I know nothing about Cisco, so.
So we're happy to hear him tonight. I'm going to turn it over to Don.
Just put it in your pocket. Okay. Okay. Like was said, I'm Don Benny. I'm a senior network services specialist for Gray Bar Electric, and like I said, that means I know nothing about Cisco. Don't believe me? Ask Barry. Barry might tell you that I am unofficially known as King of Network Monitoring. So my job involves basically trying to figure out what just happened on the network and making sure the servers are up and all the applications are processing, and then if they're not processing or the network isn't up, someone's getting a page as long as it's not me. We use a lot of Tivoli products and stuff like that, so it's a interesting job, and I get to see a lot of stuff, but like I said, for the most part, when the pagers are going off, it's not something that I have to fix. It's something Barry has to fix. I am the co-president of the Gateway Area Macintosh Users Group, and I am unquestionably and undeniably and unapologetically a Mac geek. So, first of all, hardware requirements for OS X 10.5. 867 megahertz G4. You can get around this. I have personally run it on a 700 megahertz G4. It either involves, you know, using target disk mode or hacking the installer and removing the little line in the script that says, you know, if greater than or equal to 867 megahertz, then install. Not too difficult, but you may or may not want to do that, because on some of the lesser machines, it's not so much the processor speed that will cause you a problem. It's the graphics chips and other things that they were putting in the machines. So Leopard is probably more graphics intensive of a release than any of the other previous ones. Apple says 512 megabytes of memory. It's 1 gig, realistically. I mean, OSs are nice, but when you boot up and all your memory has been used and you can look at your shell, that's not much fun. So, 1 gig realistically, if you're going to be doing anything crazy like video editing a whole bunch, you know, like with Final Cut Pro or Final Cut Express or something like that, you're going to need a lot more memory. But if you're using iMovie or just some of the iApps and just doing consumer stuff, you can usually get away with 1 gig. They've got more detailed information on their website, tech specs. So if you have a machine that's on the edge and you want to know a little bit more, you can go there and get some more information. So, big news for, I guess, this group, as far as OS X 10.5 is concerned, was the new Unix certifications that the OS achieved. There were rumblings with the previous releases that they were calling it Unix, but they had no right to call it Unix because it wasn't certified. So with 10.5, they went through a process and achieved single Unix specification 03 compliance. They are compliant with POSIX for the C API, as well as the shell, the born shell in this case, as well as POSIX threads. So if you're, you know, worried about any of that kind of stuff, it's now compliant, but you know, they say Linux. Yeah, you know, they say Linux isn't Unix either, but whatever. So, something brand new in 10.5: directory services and authentication. Netinfo, lookupd, memberd are all gone. If you've ever used Mac OS before, you know, or a lot of Unix people at least in the beginning, first start looking around the file system and eventually hit etsy, and they look at their etsy password or something, or etsy group file, and they go, where is everything? Etsy password and etsy group and those ilk are only actually used in single user mode. Everything else in previous OS X releases was controlled by something called NetInfo. NetInfo maintained all of your users, all of your groups. It maintained information on any kind of auto mounts you may have set up, as well as some other things about permissions as well. So that system worked okay for Next, and when OS X came out, OS 9 wasn't really multi-user, so they said, hey, we need a multi-user system, so we'll just take NetInfo also. The problem with NetInfo was everything was stored in a BerkeleyDB database, which was prone to just corrupting itself. There was one time a posting on a NetInfo list that says, never trust any software that automatically makes a backup of itself. NetInfo would actually make a backup copy of its database, and then if it ran a checksum on the database and it didn't match the previous one it had run, it would actually copy the backup back over and try and protect you that way. It was a system that worked for the most part, but it was hairy. It also interfaced with LookupD, and every time a user tried to log in, NetInfo would get the request, and it would first hand it off to LookupD, and LookupD would check Etsy group and Etsy password and go, nope, still nothing in there. And then would pass it back to NetInfo, and then NetInfo would check its database and go, yeah, this user is actually there. MemberD was something that came in 10.4 to try and help with group membership and group lookups, and it just turned out to be a bigger mess because all of those, NetInfo, LookupD, MemberD, all had cache files, and inevitably your cache file would get corrupt, and then weird things would happen, like you couldn't log in, or you could log in, but you had no permissions to do anything, or you didn't actually belong to the correct group. Or in LookupD's case, since LookupD also handled DNS resolution, maybe you couldn't get anywhere on the internet, which was always a fun one. So in 10.5, after many, many years of Apple saying, this is all going to go away, this is all going to go away, this is all going to go away, 7 years later, it finally went away. And basically what they did was they took all the information that was in NetInfo, and then they had it regurgitate into a whole bunch of XML files that are located in var db ds local nodes. And these XML files are in the Apple plist format. So if you've ever been on a Mac before or taken a look at a plist, you know they're all fairly standard. They follow a set format. And basically plists are designed so that Apple can basically write out configuration files, but then present a nice little GUI to the user whenever they're using them, whenever they have to interface with them, as opposed to maybe trying to write six different formatted flat files. Also in 10.5, every 10.5 machine is a local key distribution center for Kerberos. And that comes into play with some other services that they have set up for file sharing and back to my Mac and all kinds of other things, which is really kind of weird the first time you actually see it and it works. So basically, it still doesn't work like traditional Unix does. We're not doing anything in Etsy really. You can, but by default, all of the tools and everything, especially from the GUI, are designed to work with directory services, and that's the official name for the new user and group and auto mount system. It's called directory services. So if you ever used OS X server, you know that it was all LDAP based, and there's some SASL and some other things going on there. They basically took the same concept and then just created these XML files. Yeah. If you're running an LDAP server, something that 10.5 introduced was the ability to have an external schema, which is for people that maybe have Active Directory or some other existing LDAP. Okay. The easiest route for you, maybe just to augment your schema with the Apple-specific bits. There are files, I think they're available off of Apple's website, that are schema files for OpenLDAP that will augment your schema with the attributes that an OS X box would be expecting. If you don't want to go that route, you can use the directory tool in 10.5 and actually set up mappings between what you have in your LDAP database and what OS X is expecting, and then map between those to figure out, you know, where is my user attribute, where's my group attribute, where's my home directory, and that kind of stuff. So I have not personally had to do that. I was talking with a gentleman earlier. I've used OS X server, and when you go that route, you set up what was called an Open Directory Master, which sets up LDAP for you, which sets up SASL, which Apple actually calls Password Server, and sets up Kerberos. And it's kind of funny to say, but you point your client to it, and it goes, this is an Open Directory Server, and I know how to talk to that, and boom, there you go, you've got authentication. I know it can be done with a traditional LDAP, and I know there are some tutorials. If you've ever been out to a site called afp548.com, they have a lot of information on how to integrate OS X client in particular with existing directory and authentication schemes. LaunchD. LaunchD is not exactly new in 10.5, but it's expanded its role somewhat. LaunchD was introduced in 10.4, and when it was introduced in 10.4, init went away. LaunchD is PID 1. There is no init on OS X 10.4. 10.4 also deprecated XInitD. It deprecated cron and startup items as well, but they were still there. In 10.5, XInitD is gone completely. It is officially not supported. You can install it, you can get it to run, but it's not something that's going to be part of the system going forward. It's not something that they're going to be using. And cron and startup items are still there. I mean, they're still there, they're still running, but to quote one OS X engineer, he said they are more deprecated in this release. Yeah? Yes. Cron gets started up through LaunchD, and you can still write a cron job, and it'll still work the way cron has pretty much always worked on any release of OS X. The quote-unquote real way to do it is to create a LaunchD file, and the LaunchD files are, again, XML files in Apple plist format, and then from there, it kind of depends on, you know, the next question is, well, where do I, you know, put it? And if it's something that's supposed to be system-wide, you put it in system library launch agents. If it's just for your user, there's a launch agents directory in your user account under your library folder as well. A lot of questions have come up on how to write them. If you want a little bit of help there, there's a nice free GUI program called Ligon that'll help you write your LaunchD configuration files. And LaunchD, Ligon,
L-I-G-O-N,
yes, L-I-N-G-O-N, yeah, Ligon. And that's really the quote unquote way you do it for OS X. And you know, LaunchD replaces cron. So you can do all the cron type stuff in there. They want it to replace startup items, but they're having problems getting their third-party developers to write LaunchD items as opposed to startup items, because startup items are really easy. You know, it's basically like an RC script, whereas you know LaunchD is an XML file. But Apple gave you a whole bunch of examples. If you go look at system library launch agents and launch daemons, there's over 100 new jobs that they have out there. And there are all kinds of examples on how to do things. The man page has been completely overhauled or augmented with some of the new stuff in 10.5, some of the new syntax that you can use in the XML files. And Apple's really pushing this as a way to get not only, you know, cron type stuff to happen, but also when there's an event that happens on the system that might impact the user. Let's say, you know, the user goes through a network change. You know, my laptop here spends some of its time at my house connected to my wired network, but then when I'm out and about, my wireless network kicks in. Launchd is one of those things that if your process may be affected by it, you might get a notification that way. Same thing for file systems appearing and disappearing. You know, if it wasn't for the dang users disconnecting their USB hard drive all the time, we wouldn't need this. But you know, they built that kind of stuff in there. So you can take a look at that. And if you have any questions, there is a dedicated list out on macOS Forge specifically for Launchd. Stuff we stole from Solaris. ZFS. In 10.5, if you just install it from disk, you get read support. I don't remember what build of ZFS is actually in the retail version of OS 10.10.5. But again, you can go out to macOS Forge. They have an updated build available. And that will also enable the write support for you. If you want to...
I thought the write version was only on 10.0.
That was when Leopard was first released. There has since been an updated build that synced it with, at least then, the current Solaris version, and that was packaged up and released in a downloadable format. You can also go out to macOS Forge and do an SVN get of the current source and compile it yourself. There's instructions on how to do that as well.
Is this by Apple?
Okay. If you're going to mess around with ZFS, you probably want to subscribe to the users list that they have set up there off of that page, because there are some known bugs, and they're pretty upfront about it. There are a couple of things that, if you do it, will according to them, cause kernel panics. There's still no boot support, so contrary to what some certain Sun CEO said in some presentation, it is not the default file system, nor can it be the default file system for 10.5. They also took AutoFS from Solaris. Now, AutoFS has been around for a while, but they're using the Solaris implementation, so it's basically AutoFS 5.
That's good, because
Yeah. The previous auto mount process was just insane, and the format for writing the configuration file was just about completely undocumented. So good luck getting it to work.
Whenever your server went down for too long, it got a stale handle and it wouldn't recover from it.
Yep. And typically, typically the way this presented itself to the to a home user or something was, they would have their airport disk, which is, you know, Apple's little 802.11 pod that you can plug a USB hard drive in, and then something would happen on the network, or their wireless would go away or whatever, and they were connected to that disk, and then the whole machine would just sit there and the little beach ball would come up. That doesn't really happen anymore. If the disk goes away, you get the little beach ball for a couple of seconds, and then it's gone. And then you get a little dialogue message that says that blah, 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 share has unexpectedly dismounted or something to that effect.
Does it support direct OS?
Yes, it does. Dtrace. They stole that out of Solaris and wrote a whole bunch of probes for it. And then in typical Apple fashion, where everything is either shiny, pulsates, or throbs in some sort of fashion, they wrote an application called Instruments.
Is that on the recorder, by the way?
Probably. They wrote an application called Instruments, which will present a list of basically probes that you can use. And then if you're not happy with any of the probes, you can use the GUI interface to help write your own. And it's all, if anyone's ever used GarageBand, sort of in the GarageBand style, where you select your probe, drag it over, select another probe, drag it over, and then you hit the go button, and then little lines start getting drawn in the time sequence. GarageBand is the consumer audio editing program that, that ships with iLife for OS X. That's a different presentation. Or you can go to one of the Gateway Area Macintosh users group and we'll explain iLife. Well, there is that too. With the dTrace implementation, they did some cool stuff and some not cool, so cool stuff. The cool stuff is they took the Ruby probe. So if you're a Ruby scripter and you know echoing variables out to your shell just isn't cutting it for you anymore, there's a dTrace probe that you can load up. There's also one for Python. Ruby and Python have gained a lot of popularity in the Mac space and even in just the general Unix space. And Apple seems to be trying to push them probably for future development. Yeah?
How compatible is the Apple dTrace with Sun dTrace? If I've got dTrace scripts that I've got on Sun box, can I just copy them over the OS X box and have them work out of the box?
Got no idea. From what I've read on the dTrace list, chances are fairly good. Most of the standard probes that you'd find in Solaris are on OS X, not all. Specifically, kernel extensions for OS X right now don't have a probe. So you can trace the kernel, but you can't trace anything that any of the extensions that might have been loaded into it. That's something that they're working on. Titled this one Security. Top of the list was access control lists. In 10.4, access control lists were available. They were on by default in OS X server, but the consumer version of OS X shipped with them off by default. There was a command line program that you could run and enable them or disable them. And for the most part, there was no visual representation of them whatsoever in the 10.4 GUI. In 10.5, they are on by default. And if you've ever used the get info window to try and manage your permissions in a GUI way, you can also manage some of your access control lists from the get info panel as well. It's kind of limited. I mean, it's pretty much limited to adding users and groups and then telling whether or not those users and groups, in addition to the owner, the group, and other, have read or write access. But ACLs themselves, you can set an ACL and have it, you know, deny delete permissions for a particular user or a particular group. You can also create an ACL that tells the user that he's not allowed to set ACLs. So there's a man page for Chon, if you are Chagrup, Chamad, there we go, that will tell you how to use ACLs.
Standard Project ACL.
No, they are not. They are Windows ACLs.
What?
They went with the Windows ones. The only answer that anyone ever came up with that was they wanted their OS X server to be more compatible with Active Directory and a Windows environment. So they went with ACLs that are not 100% compatible with Windows, but much, much closer.
So how does that affect backups? I mean, what backup apps break with it or don't preserve ACLs?
Right now, if you're running Retrospect, from what I understand, earlier versions of it did not preserve ACLs. ACLs are really just sort of extended attributes on the file system anyway. And the 10.5 command line utilities of rsync will preserve the ACLs if you tell it to do so. By default, I don't believe it will, but there is a flag that you can pass off to it to get it to preserve the ACLs, as well as any other extended attributes that may be on the file. Did you have a particular backup?
Well, rsync was one of the ones that I was thinking of.
Okay. If you use...
I'm thinking in terms of like some of the mandatory access control in like SE Linux, where TAR doesn't necessarily understand that level All,
okay, yeah. Tar and everything else understands the ACLs. Everything that ships with OS X understands what it means to have an access control list on it. Now, whether or not if you move that to something else, non-Mac, it'll understand it.
Like you can save it, but can you restore it on the other machine?
Right, yeah, exactly. And there are slight differences between the ACLs from 10.4 and 10.5. So that's caused some people some grief when they were upgrading. All of a sudden, an ACL is interpreted a little bit differently. So I don't know. You asked if they were the regular POSIX ACLs. I'm not sure. They seem to be going on a path, and I would eventually think that we would see NFS v4 integrated into OS X, and I'm not sure how they're going to resolve NFS v4 and ACLs on OS X versus the ones that you can have on Solaris. I've got no idea. I think it's probably just going to be a big mess, actually. There's a sandbox utility in 10.5, and right now it's pretty much undocumented. There, if you go out to user share sandbox, there are some example files, and they have some processes on 10.5 running in a sandbox. But there's no man page, there's no developer documentation. The files that are in the sandbox directory there have comments in them like, we think this can be uncommented because this was a bug in the WWDC build, but we're not sure. So it's experimental. You may or may not get it to work the way you think it should, and so far, at least publicly, no one can tell you if what you think you're doing is actually what should be done. So my guess is in 10.6, whenever that comes out, there will be official sandbox documentation or seatbelt. Supposedly, at least in one of the configuration files, the original name for this was called seatbelt. I don't know, whatever. And what was that?
Expert agents use the sandbox.
Right.
Did you say expert agent?
Expert?
X-Grid agent.
X-Grid.
Yeah, so if you're running an X-Grid cluster, when you start it up, it's automatically sandboxed to specific directories as well. They're not limiting network support. If you use Quick Look on 10.5, which is the fast preview that they have from the Finder, that's been sandboxed, but the only thing the sandbox really does for Quick Look is disallow it to connect to anything on the network. Some new helpers that came along in 10.5. There's an official SSH agent now in OS X, and it officially has keychain support. So if you were running SSH keychain before, to try and store your password or store your identities in the OS X keychain, it's already integrated in 10.5, which is good because I was running it on SSH keychain on 10.4, and for some unknown reason, periodically when you woke up, especially a laptop from sleep, it would just go up to 100% CPU. And the developer acknowledged this as a bug, but he couldn't figure out what was going on. So it happened periodically, and his solution was, well, just reboot. I don't know what's going on. So fortunately, the SSH agent supplied by Apple doesn't seem to have this problem. And you can store all of your identities in the keychain, and you can tell it to remember the password so that when you SSH to a machine that has your appropriate certificate on it, you never get prompted for a password or anything like that, which, if that's what you're aiming for, okay. Improved X11. If you've ever used X11 under any of the prior versions of OS X, X11.app, as it was called, is kind of a mismatch of things that came out of X386 and stuff that was being developed in X.org, and they went and weird things happened. Now it's all X.org code. Weird things are still happening. But again, the nice thing is they've opened up a lot of their customizations and put it out on macOS Forge. And there's a community that sprung up and actually is improving the X11 implementation on OS X. And in the latest 10.5.2 release, there was some fixes for X11, and it actually had code changes in it from the community-supplied version. And the community is providing officially sanctioned downloads of code snapshots to improve X11. So things are getting better. A little nice improvement is that X11 can be started from launchd. So if you go out to that previous path and you take a look at the configuration file for X11 in launchd, you'll see that launchd is waiting for some IPC communication for X. And basically, when it hears IPC communication for X, it goes, oh, need to start X11.app. Starts up X11.app and automatically hands it off. So if you're forking around in the terminal and you type in XIs for whatever reason or something like that, before in 10.4 and before, what would happen is it would just complain that it couldn't connect to the display. Now it pauses for a second, boots up X11, then XIs displays or whatever you're trying to do. This also works remotely through SSH. So if you're tunneling your X through SSH using like the dash X command line flag, once you make the connection, in the background X will start up. And then if you issue any X commands on the remote side, they'll be tunneled back and you didn't have to set your display and you didn't have to start up X on the OS X side at all. It just happened for you. White area bonjour. Bonjour is the inappropriately named rendezvous. And that is basically a implementation of zeroconf, which is IETF something something something. And that is the link local address and naming scheme for local subnets. So by default, if you have a group of Macs and you all plug them into to a switch or something like that, they'll all configure themselves with an IP address, and they'll all have names, and you'll be able to do lookup queries against the names and stuff like that, and ping them via name, and that's all thanks to Bonjour. And that's been in OS X for at least since 10.2. What's new in 10.5 was they added wide area support for that. And for wide area support, to the consumer, that's basically how their back to my Mac service works. Basically, you can set up an augmented DNS server, and then you can tell your OS X 10.5 clients to register with the server, no matter where they're at, and then they'll be able to find not only the other machines, but the thing with Bonjour is you can find machines, but you can also find services. So like Apache on OS X is Bonjour enabled. So when you start up Safari, it'll find any Bonjour-enabled web servers that may be running on your subnet, or in this case, if you're in a wide area situation, that are part of your wide area setup. That's how Back to My Mac works. There's a little client that basically registers you with the custom DNS server that Apple has running in your own little namespace, and then when you have it running on two separate machines, one machine may be being back at home and one machine may be being at work. In the sidebar, you can see the second machine and get back to it for file sharing and screen sharing and all that kind of fun stuff. File system events. In 10.4, there was a DevFS events, and Spotlight basically read from that, and it was kind of like reading from a fire hose, because everything that happened on the file system as far as changes were being spewed out from there. So Spotlight needed to know if there was a change to a file, or file got deleted, file got updated in some way, so that it can go re-index it, because that's what Spotlight was doing. It was indexing the contents of a file, and then when the user went up to the little magnifying glass up in the right-hand corner and typed in their search query, it would check its database for the query. And it was doing all of that by reading that DevFS events. In 10.5, since people said, hey, that's really kind of cool, I'd like to use my application could take advantage of that, they created this FS events framework so that instead of trying to read DevFS events, there's another process called FS event D that sits there and reads that for you. And then at the root of every hard drive that's plugged into a machine, it writes a little log file of changes that have occurred at the directory level, basically. So if you change a file in a particular directory, it writes a little log entry. The files are binary, that a change has occurred. And then it's up to your application, if you're trying to take advantage of this, to go figure out what the change was. So you'll get a notification that there's been a change that has occurred in this directory, and your application, it's assumed, will have taken a snapshot of the before, and then we'll reconcile that with the after. This is essentially the way Time Machine works on 10.5. Since HFS Plus, which is the default file system on OS X, has no snapshot support of its own, we couldn't do something cool like, you know, take snapshots every so often and then, you know, reconcile it. Maybe when we get ZFS that'll happen. But essentially what happens is this FS events is writing a log. So when you first install OS X and then you turn on Time Machine, it backs up everything to the hard drive. And then it makes a little mental note of the state of the machine. And then if you let it go, every hour it queries that FS events log and says, okay, what's changed? And then it reconciles what it knew an hour ago with what it knows now. And then it backs up those little files over to a hard drive, network share, wherever you may be having your Time Machine backups. And the Time Machine backups are the reason Apple added hard linking to directories. Because if you open up your Time Machine backup, you'll see that it's nothing more than a directory layout of your computer, and current points to the way things are right now. And if you go back in time, you can see where, you know, you changed files and where new files were added. I think they probably could have gotten away with just hard linking to a file, but they wanted to do it at the directory level, so they added the capability to hard link to directories. Programming. Objective-C 2.0. For anyone who doesn't know, Objective-C is the preferred method to write applications on OS X. If you're writing an OS X native application, they'd like you to take advantage of Objective-C as well as the Cocoa frameworks. You can, of course, use Java or C or whatever else, but if you're going to write a quote-unquote Mac app, they want you to be using Objective-C. And in 2.0, they added garbage collection, so no more pesky memory management, as well as some syntax enhancements just to make it a little bit easier to write your loops. So, you know, everyone here is probably familiar with Perl and the for each syntax. That's the kind of things that they added to Objective-C 2.0. They also added the ability to program in Ruby or Python beyond just simple shell scripts, basically. Previously, Ruby and Python were installed as part of the system, and you know, you could write any sort of Ruby or program or Python program that you wanted, but you would have to use like a third-party toolkit if you wanted to do any kind of GUI manipulation. Now you can actually use Ruby and Python to create, quote-unquote, a real Mac application, interface with the Cocoa frameworks, and create an actual OS X app. They also added the ability to control Mac applications that are scriptable. So if you ever used a Mac before, used AppleScript, even from like the way back days of System 7, System 8, that kind of thing, you know that AppleScript was the way that you told some other GUI application on the Mac that you wanted to do something. And in my opinion, AppleScript is a read-only language. If you can find an example that does what you want, great. If you have to modify that example, good luck. Because there's syntax changes and it's written like English, and it makes no sense to me. Because my version of English is apparently not the same version of English that they were thinking about when they wrote that language. Yeah, it really was. But since I guess HyperTalk is dead, these are our replacements. Automator was the consumer application that was released in 10.4 to try and help the average user write scripts. It didn't really, you know, help them write a script per se, but it helped them write a workflow, and they drug things that they wanted to do off of the sidebar into this, you know, chronological view, and then wired everything up. That worked for the most part, but really only scripters or people that liked programming played with it a whole lot. I did have one guy tell me last night at the Gamma meeting that Automator is great if you have to batch rename a whole bunch of files. Okay, you know, you could just drop into the shell and do that, but this guy was never going to do that. But there's an Automator action to do that.
There's GUI tools to do that, too, based on
right, but...
Everybody wants to do things the hard way.
So, right. So in 10.5, we went back to the future in Automator, because in OS 10 or in System 7 or System 8, I don't remember where they added it. If you fired up the Apple Script Editor, there was this record button, and then you could go about doing things in the GUI, and it would record what you did, and then you can make some little tweaks to it, and it basically wrote your script for you. In Automator, they've added this thing called Watch Me Do, and it's the same thing. It builds your workflow and your script for you. You might have to make some modifications to it. It's not going to be 100% accurate. Some applications...
The old one wasn't either.
Yeah, the old one wasn't either. Some applications don't have very good GUI scripting support, and they don't really tell the GUI what's going on. So in those cases, Automator... and even AppleScript in the old days would just kind of sit there and take a guess or do nothing at all. The guess was sometimes right, most of the time it was wrong. Yeah.
The last one.
Yeah.
So AppleScript is being deprecated now?
No. No. There's still someone somewhere using it. I would imagine that Apple probably uses it a lot internally. I'm told that there are large print and publishing houses that have entire workflows built on it. I don't know.
Well, they did that with Factory Text, too.
Yeah.
There were lots of people using it and not publishing it because it was internal massive bodies of work.
Right. And the weird thing with AppleScript, the guys that got really good at it, for the most part, were the ones that figured out how to write AppleScript extensions, because you could write extensions in C and compile them, and then they just wrote an AppleScript command to call their C program, basically, to do whatever it was that they wanted to do. That kind of seems like it's defeating the purpose. But if you insist on using AppleScript, you'll be pleased to know that it is now finally Unicode enabled, so all of your strings can be written in whatever language you feel like.
Simplified or traditional.
Yes, exactly. There has been an OSA script command line utility that has shipped with OS 10 ever since it came out. And OSA script, you could basically redirect an AppleScript file into it and it would process it. The weird thing about AppleScript was it used a different comment character than normal scripting languages. It thought that the hash symbol meant something else. So you couldn't create a signature line at the top of the file, you know, pound bang slash bin slash OSA script, and then your AppleScript and have it work. In 10.5, they fixed that. Hash is now a comment character, and you can create a signature line along with your AppleScript, make it executable, and off it goes, if you're into that. If you're a Ruby programmer and you like Rails, there's a full Rails implementation. I don't remember exactly what version it is, but it comes complete with Gems and Capistrano for deployment. There's some good stuff happening with Rails. I've been trying to learn it, but I do a couple of tutorials and then real life interrupts. So I mean to get back to it someday. And sort of the big news was Cocoa went 64-bit in 10.5. So in 10.4, you could write a command line application or a background task that didn't interface with the GUI and have it be 64 bits. In 10.5, you can write a full Cocoa GUI app and have it be 64-bit. The weird thing is, in 10.5, the kernel is still 32-bit. So you can have a 64-bit program running on a 32-bit kernel, and basically, it seems like they did that because they didn't want to have all their developers go back and try and rewrite device drivers or create second device drivers and then tell the user, okay, you're on a 64-bit machine and you have to use the 64-bit version. Because most Mac users are going to go, what? I bought this white computer and I would like the program and my printer to work. So maybe someday they'll change the kernel to 64-bit. Maybe in 10.6, maybe in 10.7. I have an idea that it probably won't be anytime until well after they've stopped shipping 32-bit machines completely. And up until, I think, the end of last year, they were still shipping a couple of 32-bit machines because the Mini still had one of the Core Duos in it. So that was 32-bit. Now all the shipping machines are 64-bit. So I would assume it's only a matter of time. So that was sort of our whirlwind tour of what's new in the Unix land for OS X. We can have questions. I can try and demo something. We can look at the GUI if you guys want to see the GUI. We can all go to Malone's. I don't know. Yeah?
I've been puzzled by creating and managing groups on 10.4.
Uh-huh.
You say we do have a prescribed way to do that in 10.5 now?
Groups? Yes.
And it really was weird in 10.4, wasn't it? That wasn't just my imagination.
No, it was weird in 10.4 because 10.4 still had netinfo. So you had to fire up the netinfo manager and go to the groups subdirectory and then start configuring your groups from there. There was no intuitive way to do it because when you went to the accounts preference pane, you could add a user. Mm-hmm. Okay? Yeah. What group does he belong to?
Well, his own group.
Right. How do I get him to belong to a different group?
How do I get two users to belong to the same group? That's, that is a useful feature to have.
Could it web him around on the Mac?
Yes, it does.
Well, that'd be the way to do it.
That's one way to do it, yes.
You tell them about groups and stuff like that. I happen to be involved in a discussion at work today. But what's the Mac OS concept of file sharing between two Mac OS's and then having, you know, two users with the same group or the same user ID and
the file sharing systems that Macs have used for decades now has been the Apple filing protocol. So if you had a couple of Macs or even a whole work group of Macs tied to a server, you used AFP. And AFP was user-based in that you logged into it with a username and password. It didn't matter if that username and password was the username and password that you were using to log in your machine. Because before OS X, there were no users and passwords except for file sharing. You booted the machine, it presented the GUI, and you did whatever it was that you were going to do. With OS X, you know, we had all of these weird user IDs and groups, and you had to log in, and Apple tried to hide that fact from you for the most part, because by default, when you first installed OS X 10.0, it would automatically log you in as this user that you created and then forgot about during the install process. It didn't really even tell you that you had created the user, because people were so afraid about this concept of, you know, why do I have to type in a user and password? It's my machine, I should be able to use it. So for file sharing, it didn't matter. You typed in a user and password that your administrator gave you or that you set up on your other Mac, and then it just mapped everything back to the permissions that you had, which in System 7 through 9 was nothing. In OS X, it's whatever user you're logged in as. So does that answer your question?
Well, it gives me an insight. Like you said, user administration was done by the file sharing mechanism, unlike the, we talked briefly earlier, NFS, you know, where it's like in the real Unix world, you got like, oh, got all these multi-user systems
that
think that they understand what user identity is about, and now we want to get those multi-user systems to play in the same sandbox. What do we do to ensure that when I say UID this and you say UID that, we're talking about the same guy.
Right. And basically, up until 10.5, trying to use NFS was kind of a pain. It was kind of recommended for large situations that you not do it. Now, you probably...
Right.
Yeah.
It's been there for several years.
It works.
Well, NFS is what we got. I'm not sure that if we started the day with all the security features that we know about, that we would design a file sharing protocol that looked like NFS. We might pick something else in the post HTML, right? I mean, the whole idea of a URL, right, or Universal Resource Locator.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if when he came up with, and it's read only, that's why it works. But it's like, you know, no matter where you are on the network, every file's got its own unique name. Come get it.
We don't have that for users, though.
Well, it's read only. You're not trying to do updates.
No,
so
that's not necessarily true. Something called web app is a writable version of HTTP.
Yeah, yeah.
I prefer the Fish protocol, which is basically files over SSH, FTP, and it works great if we could just solve that user issue, and if we could integrate it into Mac OS, it'd be awesome.
If you use Fuse. Okay. Yeah, you can get at it with Fuse as well.
What I really like is what KDE does, and unless you type, you know,
right,
fish colon URL.
Yeah, and in order for that to happen, like in the Finder, they'd have to add the protocol handler for it, and maybe one of these days, I don't know. But back to the original question, accounts. Yes, that's displaying up there. So here you can see I'm Don Benny. I'm the admin of this machine. I have a test user. He's a standard. I've disabled the guest account. By default, 10.5 has a guest account. Like, let's say your family comes over and they want to check their email. You can let them log in with the guest account, and when they log out, it erases any trace that they were there. But I'm kind of paranoid in some respects, so I don't really see a reason to have it enabled if guests aren't supposed to be using my laptop. And then you'll see that there's this groups down here, and I have one called Test G. So let me authenticate. And under the login options, there's the plus and minus button down here. And this was pretty much the dialog that you'd be presented in 10.4. In 10.5, we can change it to group. So we can create a new group, give it a name. Remember, they're slightly paranoid about what they're...
What was that UID in there?
You got a universal.
User. Yeah. By default, when you create a new user or group for a client machine that's not part of a directory system, it calculates that for you automatically. And it actually sticks that in its directory services. But for the most part, a normal user would never see that. Go ahead and mess around with it if you want. Destroy your account, maybe. I don't know. And then, you know, when you create a group, like Test G here, you have this little visual representation of who can be in there and who is in there.
I'm guessing you can drag other members into that from the list on the left.
Well, if you create a new user, they'll show up in the accounts, under this accounts here, and then you just check box them off whether or not you want them to be part of that group or not. I mean, this is... You're not going to be deploying this directory service to a whole bunch of people, so the assumption here is that you're not going to be creating users and groups and having 500 different ones of them. Yeah, if you're in a server environment or something, this is all going to be stored in LDAP. Exactly. Yeah. So, like the groups there, when you go to advanced options for a user, it gives you some of the same options, and there's this big warning message that if you change anything here, you might break something. Finally, the nice thing, we've been given a tool that can actually change easily the user's default home directory. So, you know, especially if you were on a tower machine, like one of the Mac Pros, or really any machine, but especially the Mac Pros, and let's say that you had a 10,000 RPM disk for your boot drive, because you wanted everything to be fast on it, but you sort of had like a slow drive that your user account was sitting on. It was really hard to get netinfo to remember that your user account was supposed to be on this other disk. Now with directory services, you can tell it that it's going to be on another disk, and then it seems to be fairly decent at remembering all that type of information. Because let's face it, if it gets corrupt, it's just a flat file. You can go in and edit it. For the most part, people that I've talked to that have used this say you want to do it, like if you're going to create a user and then move them to another drive. That's the easiest way to do it. If you have an existing user and then you want to move it to another drive, you can do it, but there's going to be this freak out moment where you log into that user and if you haven't moved all the contents of his hard drive manually, like from the shell, you're not going to see anything. Because if I were to say that my user or this particular user was on a different drive and then log in with him, OS X is going to go, oh, there doesn't seem to be a user home directory there. Well, I'll create one for you. And another weird thing upon login is if it goes, oh, there is a home directory there, but his default permissions aren't correct, I'll change those for you.
Fix them for you.
Yes. It's going to be helpful. Maybe.
It'll also create a desktop if it isn't there.
Yes.
And other systems sometimes don't like that.
Yeah. Aliases are things that I may be known as. So if we look at my user account here, you'll see that I have an alias for .Mac. And .Mac uses your user ID at mac.com, which is both your email address as well as your login to the web services. And .Mac also calculates a nice little universal ID for you as well. So when I'm interfacing with .Mac, like through back to my Mac or something like that, if I've logged in with one of the, dbenny at mac.com, or if it grabbed my universal ID, it knows that that still maps back to this dbenny on this machine. Other questions?
One thing I've been noticing is sometimes there are features in Tiger that I don't really want to have. And I mean, they're just something I don't use, and mm-hmm. I'd like to maybe not dedicate so much CPU power to it.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering, have they come up with any way to downgrade, to deselect certain features so that this could run on something slower than 800 megahertz?
There is no, other than at the install time where you can optionally select not to have a few things installed.
So you need to be creative.
Yeah. Okay. I think they, I mean, The machine that I tested with a 700 megahertz processor, it worked just fine. Now, I had a different video card than the one that shipped with it in that machine. I think that was probably the key. I think they went a little overboard with the processor requirements because they rewrote all of their startup scripts and everything to be launch deagents. So there's a lot of stuff that doesn't even kick in unless you use it. And then LaunchD starts it up for you. And then when you're done with it, LaunchD shuts it down.
Ooh, that's nice.
So I think they could have been a little bit more lenient. But I think the hardware specifications have always been, like such G4 with USB or something. Well, it's not the USB ports that are important. It was something else that they were putting on those motherboards that, the graphics card or whatever.
It's that, just that when they put the USB on the motherboard, it's other stuff.
Like right, exactly. So I would say if you're fine with a few little visual glitches here and there, you can hack the installer and get it to work just fine.
So have you seen the place in the installer or seen notes on it where it's pretty good to fix that so that...
I have seen the place in the installer. There are instructions on this website called Google that will tell you all about it. The easiest way to do it and the method that I used was I have three machines at home, two of them PowerPC based and then this one Intel. And basically the one PowerPC machine was 700 megahertz. The other one's a G5 iMac. I took a FireWire cable, I took the G4 tower, plugged it into the G5 iMac, put the installer disk in, and then told it to install on that hard drive. And then the G4 booted up just fine. But if you don't have that capability, you have to basically create a disk image, hack the installer, write it back out to a DVD, that kind of thing.
Doesn't require you to have
I haven't seen that one then.
Somebody sent me a copy of it.
Okay.
Yeah. It was a similar way.
Yeah, the last one I saw said create a disk image.
That one too. That was more painful.
Install it under a disk image?
Basically create a disk image of the DVD, the installed DVD, mm-hmm. and then find this file and edit it, because the DVD is obviously read-only.
Yeah.
You could burn a new one, or if you have partitions set up on your hard drive, you could just empty the contents to the hard drive and then run the install from the hard drive, which also in 10.5 you gain the ability through Disk Utility to do live resizing of your hard drive partitions, which you could do from the command line in 10.4, but it was sometimes prone to error, and if you were like me, you had three partitions and you deleted one of them and you had 20 gigs of free space, but the OS didn't think so. I'm not sure where it went. it just not there. Okay. But 10.5 doesn't seem to have that problem, because I've resized this partition a couple of different times. And if you're a boot camp user and you run the utility and you create your Windows partition, that's actually what's going on.
What goes on down at that level? I mean, they switch. What is the CPU is what basis now? Are we Intel based? Or
yes.
X86 based?
All shipping Macs are x86 based now.
So what does that make your disk, your hard, but the hard drives are SCSI, is that it, rather than, is there IDE drives?
Serial ATA.
Serial ATA.
Yeah.
I mean, so are we back to your basic low-level partitioning scheme of primary, pre-primary, the way that DOS works? I mean, DOS isn't really the right answer either. It's in your BIOS, right? I mean, your disk partitioning happens at the sub-OS level.
Right.
So
that happens to the
bootloader
and the MBR, the 400
bytes. Yeah, but we're x86 based. We're x86 based now, but we're not using a BIOS. We're using EFI.
Using what?
EFI.
Okay.
So it works a little bit differently than the traditional BIOS does. In fact, in order to get Boot Camp to work, Apple had to release a patch for their EFI implementation because they didn't have BIOS compatibility. So when you tried to boot Windows, it went, what? I don't know. There's no MBR here. I don't understand. What's going on? So things are a little bit different than your traditional Windows or Linux x86 BIOS world.
That's kind of, I'm asking you a question about that, and when do we get to talk on that? When do we get to talk on the Mac BIOS? But you're talking about partitioning, and
right.
You're touching on that, right? You're touching on where is the hard drive partitioned? Is it down at that EFI level or whatever you just said?
The partition map actually, I believe, happens at the OS level, I think. Isn't the OS responsible for writing that?
No.
Something has to know how to
boot it.
Use it before you
right.
It, yeah.
So
and that's not true in a PC BIOS, right? The PC BIOS, the OS, the BIOS does the disk partitioning, and the OS resides in the partition.
No.
The BIOS understands how to interpret the partition.
Right.
Okay.
But the
I think he's right.
The BIOS knows how to get to the disk and
right.
load the first sector
right.
and MBR.
Right.
That's it.
Right.
The BIOS does nothing with partition.
Then on its OS.
Oh yeah.
You're right. It's OS, but it's really, I guess it's bootloader or
just the MBR.
No, it knows to access disks. Hmm? It knows how to access disk 0 or 8.0 and 8.1.
Yeah.
So
that's it. It loads a little program.
Or that program whatever. Your MBR program.
You're right.
So obviously, if you can find someone that knows how this happens, I will be attending that talk because I don't.
I mean, because we're all so familiar with the PC's disk partitioning scheme, but you go to any of your other vendors, like I was educated on SGI's disk partitioning scheme and got familiar with that, and HP's got theirs, and Sun's got theirs, and each proprietary, so it is at the OS level, even though they're all just using SCSI disks, but it's like, yeah, well, we number our sectors, but we letter our sectors, even Linux itself, right, uses HDA and HDC, whereas BSD uses a different identifier for all of its partitions.
Right.
But what? But down at the partition table level, what is that called? I mean, it's not a FAT. FAT is the file system, right?
Right.
What
is three of them actually that the Mac supports? The old one, which is the Apple partition.
Right.
Which is the PowerPCs know how to boot. They only understand the Apple partition map. And then you have GUID, which is the new Intel.
Yeah, if you're using EFI from as a replacement for a BIOS, you use GUID.
But you can actually boot an Intel Mac to an Apple partition, but you can't do a firmware update.
Right. Yeah.
So, and you could, if you do like a Leopard install on an Apple partition, Mac, you can boot the older PowerPC and an Intel Mac.
Right. And that's the.
You can do a GUID, you can only boot an Intel.
And that's the recommended way if you're in a support environment to try and create a universal boot disk for all of your machines. But what goes on at that level, I've got no idea.
No, but it sounds like this man understands that there's at least three different things that can go on at that level.
Yes, there are. But then when they break, you go, what?
How do you find it?
Yeah. Exactly.
So what do you, one last time. What do you call that layer? If you don't, if that partitioning layer, I mean, if you don't call it BIOS and you don't really call it OS...
It's just the partition map. Yeah.
Right? And so we're familiar with the PC DOS partition map. Is that what most of the Linux uses the PC DOS partition map? Are you named Apple map?
Apple partition map is what they is one of them. Classic.
GUID
is another one. I think there's a third one that's for OS 9. Further back than that.
There are three.
Three options in the disk utility.
Yeah, there are three options.
I want to format my disk to find out.
But I'm not. I
think there's a new standard you mentioned about EFI.
Right.
Go to Google search or Wikipedia and look under partitioning and it leads to an EFI that talks about all these other 12 different ways of doing things and a new standard they're trying to all get back into. It falls under this EFI thing.
Yeah. The unfortunate thing is right now EFI is basically being used on Macs and anything with an Itanium chip, I think. So not much. Right.
That's a curse. So then the OS has the responsibility of the OS knows the file system, and then after it realizes that the file system lies in a partition, the OS has the responsibility of turning that into an actual sector call to go out and get the sector and
I believe so.
That is correct.
That's why with Windows you have to have the partition active or it doesn't know which one to boot from.
But that's the boot. I'm just saying that once the OS is up and running, there's no intermediate layer. The OS has to be smart enough to say,